Welcome to Stepping Out of Babylon, produced by Sue Supriano. Babylon is everywhere. It's the isms and schisms both in the system and within ourselves. Let's unify, stand aligned, and step out of Babylon. Hi, everybody. My name's Sue Supriano, and I'm really excited today to be speaking with the Venerable Robina Curtin. This Venerable Robina Curtin has that title because she is a Tibetan Buddhist nun, meaning not that she's from Tibet, but within the tradition of Tibetan Buddhism. And in fact, Robina, you're from Australia.
Yes, right. That's right, Sue. I am. I'm from Australia, from Melbourne. Uh-huh. Yes.
And I first heard you speak at a Women of Wisdom, I think was the name of a series here in San Francisco. But in fact, you're traveling all around the world. Oftentimes, there are many different places. And you'll tell us about that. But I want to let people know that we are going to be speaking about your Liberation Prison Project. Mm-hmm. And of course, a reason I really couldn't wait to talk to you is because I'm so happy when Buddhism becomes socially engaged, I guess, is the way we talk about it these days. I also want to let people know that you came out of a radical activist background in Australia. So maybe you just say a little bit about how you came to make this very big decision, which I think you made many, many years ago, to become a Tibetan Buddhist nun.
Uh-huh. Well, I was brought up a Catholic, Sue, in Melbourne. And I think as a kid, I don't know, if I look back on my life, the things that I've done seem quite different, but I can see a constant theme, you know, and the theme in my life all the time was somehow to try and understand the way the world is, what makes it tick, why there is suffering, why there's happiness, what causes things, you know. I mean, that's just the way my mind always worked. And also just sort of, I mean, sounding as noble as it might, but to try and find ways to make it a better place, I suppose. And so when the first part of my life as a kid, I was brought up a Catholic, and I was very devoted to God and Our Lady and the saints and loved to go to Mass. But it was very much in my heart, I think, because on the outside, I was really a pretty wicked kid, and I was always rather sad the nuns couldn't see my pure heart. But I think as a little kid, I really wanted to become a nun. That seemed to be the idealistic thing to do. But by the time I was about 15, because I used to like to read, I remember starting to read Black American literature and listen to jazz. I think that really kind of blew my mind right open and started to sort of, then all my religious aspirations started to take on a social aspect. And then by the time I was about 19, I think, 20, I made this conscious decision to say, goodbye God, hello sex and drugs and more jazz, actually. I was into jazz. And then I suppose then I went to England when I was about 23. This is in the late 60s. So for maybe 8 to 10 years, I was actively involved, kind of hippie first, but then kind of left communist politics, very active in England. And then feminist politics. Interestingly, around the time of the movement strong, the early 70s, George Jackson, the Soledad Brothers, Angela Davis, those sort of support groups in London, and I was very involved in a group called Friends of Soledad, and actually, interestingly, had a lot of contact with people in prisons in California, the very same prisons that I'm now dealing with 30 years later, but as a Buddhist, which is rather interesting. But I think after this, I became a feminist. Then radical feminist. And then I think slowly by the time I was maybe 29, starting to want something spiritual again and really sort of wanting to make the world a better place but not finding methods of not somehow being fully satisfied. So eventually when I was about, I don't know, 30, 31, bumped into these Tibetan lamas. So here I am, mm-hmm. 27 years later.
Well, just say a little bit about, because I can so much personally relate to what you're talking about. I don't know what I do without the teachings of Buddhism. And I'd like you to say something about how it is that you find that more satisfying. I mean, you could have stayed a Catholic.
No, exactly. Well, I don't know. I think for me, as a Catholic, I was completely satisfied at a devotional level. My human heart was very satisfied. You know, this kind of sense of yearning and wishing and connecting with all these amazing beings. Because I've got a kind of a radical nature, I seem to love people who go fully into something. And so these saints, these outrageous saints who just were amazing human beings, I was very inspired by them. So my heart was very satisfied. But I think my mind that needed answers and wanted to understand things wasn't. And that's not being rude. I mean, I have great respect for Catholicism. I really do. But I wasn't satisfied because that's a whole different approach, the Catholic one, you know. So when I first heard these Tibetan lamas, and then I heard that Buddha says, don't believe a single word I'm telling you, and really check it out, I was in bliss. I was so happy. Because that, and that's, I think, is a very common thing in the West, isn't it? That we want to listen, we want to think things out. And Buddha puts the onus on us. He says, okay, you guys, there is a way to describe the universe, to see reality. Reality can be known, and it's known by mind, and you have mind, so get on with it. And the extent to which you know reality, the extent to which you put yourself together, is the extent to which you're going to be happy and be more useful. So for me, it just, more and more I'm into it, the more and more I keep finding it works. And so, you know, when you're on a good thing, you keep sticking to it, don't you? Mm-hmm. But that was the main issue for me, that I had to use my mind and call it philosophy, if you like, but I mean, philosophy is just a way of describing reality. I wanted to understand reality. I wanted to see the relationship between that and human beings. And that's where Buddhism links. I mean, Buddhist psychology and philosophy completely intersect, you know. Buddha says the extent to which we're out of touch with reality, with all our dramas and attachment and anger and confusion and pride, is the extent to which we suffer and the extent to which, therefore, we harm others. So that there's this direct relationship. And I find that a supremely satisfying view of the world, you know, and I find it very workable.
Well, you have certainly put yourself in touch with reality here, a reality of a lot of what I would think was suffering.
Absolutely.
In terms of the Liberation Prison Project, prisons. And I first heard of you connected to working at Pelican Bay in California, which is in Northern California here. I've done many radio shows on it, and I know of people, you know, and people are close to people in Pelican Bay, and it's a really horrible, horrible place. The most famous in prison circles, wonderful in terms of being a high-tech torture chamber.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, that was how our connection with people in prison started, was in actually in 1996. Since 95, for seven years, I was the editor of the magazine of the organization I'm part of, the Foundation for the Preservation of the Mahayana Tradition, FPMT, that has many centers around the world. And I was editor of the magazine, Mandala, which is the magazine of the FPMT. We were based then in Santa Cruz. And in 96, we got a letter, and it landed on my desk from a young guy in the security housing unit, Shu, in Pelican Bay. And, of course, up until then, I'd had nothing to do with prisons. I mean, since I was involved politically. And his name was Arturo, and I discovered that he was 18 at the time, and he was in the security housing unit. He'd been there a couple of years, and he had a couple more years to go. In fact, he's still there now. He said he'd read books about Buddhism, was very interested in Buddhism, and wanted to know more. So it all began with this. I mean, he was very sincere. I sent him books. I visited. He eventually took refuge. And by the end of the first year, I think another 40 guys had written, all word of mouth. And so then just this thing developed. And it seemed to me these people with very little resources, this pretty intensive suffering situation, this small cell with 10 books and the inside of a pen and a toilet and a television, and that's about it, you know. And I could really, what really struck me was that, and very inspired me, and what continues to inspire me to do this work, is that I'm seeing people in situations that we would call intense suffering, but which they're truly using to their advantage. I mean, you can see that either you go crazy in that environment or you really start looking inside. And this is what I find continually inspiring about people in prison in all the situations, that they've got the courage to really look into their own minds. And this is what Buddha's exactly saying. I mean, he's saying that your external situation, of course, it can be the triggering of enormous suffering, but if we really can see that, our mind can transcend it. And that's what I'm seeing, and something very down to earth. And I mean, that's what continually inspires me, you know.
Yeah, it always seemed to me that, especially being in isolation, which is what people in the Shu are, I think I've heard they lose pigment in their skin because they never get any sun or any outside air. Anyway, that you either get it, you go crazy, or you get enlightened.
Well, I did, isn't it? That's right, exactly. And I think, I mean, yeah, what I'm learning, I mean, the guys in Shu up there, you know, there are these pods of 16 people, 8 cells, 2 to a cell usually, but some of them have 1 man cell, but I think it's so overcrowded that they're forced to be together, that you have contact with each other through the walls. I mean, because the noise is appalling. I mean, Arturo said to me one time that he said, you can't believe the noise, even though it's only 16 people. He said, it's like being in a rock concert all day. And that's something that's really struck me about being in prison in the various circumstances, that the noise is really intense. So even though you're so-called in isolation, you're so close to other people, there's no sense of privacy, you know. You've got no privacy. I mean, he said you can even hear the breathing at night of the fourth cell down, you know. So you can't even go to the toilet in peace. Everything, you're completely naked in a way. Mm-hmm. So even though it's so-called isolation, it's not at all isolation, you know. And so there's something just, yeah, so anyway.
Yeah. And now you probably visited prisons all over the place.
Yes.
Do you want to share, would you share some more about some other prisons?
Sure, absolutely. Well, the first the first few years when I was more based in California, now I'm on the road almost all the time. I gave up editing Mandela in 2000, and I'd visit people privately in various prisons in California. But then when I'd travel to the East Coast, I'd go to, you know, play like a prison in Kentucky where I see some people there, including guys on death row. Usually go every year in Illinois, in New York, in New Mexico, in Texas, various states. And since about 2000, I visit Australia once a year to teach for 2 to 3 months there, and now we've got the prison project there as well. We've got branches in almost every state, the 7 states in Australia. It's a very big country physically, but not that many people. It's maybe only half the population of California. But in most of the states, we've got monks or nuns who visit prisons there. And what's very interesting, when I go to the prisons in Australia, I have to say that in general, I mean, you know, if you talk to a prisoner in Australia, they're going to have their own problems. But in comparison with American prisons, they're like paradise. I think the system is still more humane. Maybe it's going in the same direction as here, you know, but more humane. The sentencing is not so severe. The physical prisons themselves, I mean, I've been in every state almost, and almost all of them are pretty reasonable in comparison. Much better situation, much better environment, much better people working in the prisons, people much more open. I mean, I've had more interest in Australia in the prisons from the prison authorities than from prisoners, actually. Mm-hmm. But whereas in this country, we over 7 or 8 years, we've gradually begun to develop a relationship with maybe 30, 40 chaplains in the hundreds of prisons, among the 500 prisons we've touched upon in this country, because we get now more than 200 letters every month from people in prison, but now gradually from chaplains. And so maybe just now some chaplains are getting some interest. But whereas in Australia, almost more interest immediately from the authorities, which says something about Australia, I think, where Buddhism is much more very, very popular there, actually. Mm-hmm. Very interesting.
Well, it's pretty popular in California, too, and we have more people in prison than there, a higher percentage of people than there's ever been in the history of the world. I like to say that in as many interviews as I can, because that's pretty intense. More people in prison than anywhere ever in the history of the world, including all those other countries that you hear about that are so bad, supposedly. Yeah. So a lot of things are kind of serious these days, and prisons really embody the most intense. And of course, we have people locked up now. We have the Patriot Act. No judges, no charges. It's really out of hand. I didn't intend to get all off into this, but it's so important for people to be aware.
Yeah, but I suppose, I mean, that's the thing. I think it's just a symptom, isn't it, I mean, if we're using Buddhist psychology and philosophy to interpret what we're seeing, then, you know, it just fits completely with the Buddha's view that the more anger, the more fear, the more pride, more jealousy, more attachment, then the more suffering. And therefore, the more vindictiveness, therefore, naturally, more prisons, more violence, and so the whole circle keeps going, you know. And so because we can't see prisons in a country as separate from the whole country, it's part of a bigger picture, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And that's something that I'm seeing wherever you go in the world, we're all the same, basically. We've all got, you know, using Buddha's view, we've all got this kind of wrong sense of self, which brings the attachment, which then brings anger and all the rest. But you can just see it the way it expresses itself in different ways in different countries. Mm-hmm. And somehow I think I've always noticed from my own experience in the States that from the point of view of the delusions is that there's an intense amount of fear here, which seems to be linked very much to this ignorance, which you can see how racism is an outcropping, you know, is a branch of that. It comes from that. It's this inability to see human beings as, you know, it's a paranoid, kind of fearful, angry view. And so you can see how prisons and all of this intensity and this is just a symptom of all that, you know?
Yeah, well, indeed, Venerable Robina Courtin, there is a lot of fear in the United States, and there's a really concerted effort to keep feeding that fear and making that fear bigger and bigger. I don't know if you find that in other countries.
A concerted effort on, you mean, among?
Well, by the government, I think. You know, there's a whole, you've got terrorists are everywhere, and actually we do have some things. If we were going to be afraid, we maybe should be more afraid of what's happening to our species on the planet. But, yeah, I think that the government does a lot of whipping up through the media to fear. I mean, I've seen that happen for many years with racism, and, of course, racism and war, and now we got the terrorists, which I think is all a bunch of lies, but I won't go into that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I suppose you can say that that's all a symptom of the bigger picture too, because, I mean, what else is government but a bunch of human beings who've come out of the rest of society and whom we vote for, or you know, so we can see, we look from the big picture point of view. So I suppose as a Buddhist, what we can try and do is see these symptoms, see the suffering of it, and I think this is where we have to make the leap, which is sometimes not easy for us, to see that the very, you know, the ones who've got the fear and who have the power, that that's the cause of their suffering too, because we really understand. I mean, this is what I'm seeing. If we, you know, really look deeply into Buddha's understanding of why things happen, Buddha's view of the universe, which is this one of karma, you know, which is, can be so easily understood and misused. But I mean, it's the one that really, if we understand it, it means that whatever we're experiencing now is the fruit of past actions, collective or whatever. And so all we can do is, this is where practice comes in, isn't it? And this is what I'm seeing with guys, with people in prison, that you really can see this outrageous situation you're in now, and that you have this enormous courage to accept, okay, this is my reality now, can I change it? Can I change it? So, yes, we should want to always change everything, and that's what we call political action. This is why I see no contradiction between so-called Buddhists and so-called political. But what I'm seeing myself is, which is why I turned to Buddhism, I knew I was trying to bash the world into shape. That's fantastic. I could see the world was suffering. But if I didn't work on me, if I didn't make me a better instrument, a better person, then how could I be effective, you know? So I'm seeing that the work we're doing in prison with individuals, one person at a time, basically, that it seems really slow and rather kind of passive almost, but actually I think it's really quite profound, because if one person can look into their own mind, see their own reality, change themselves and become a much more easygoing, relaxed, but much more effective human being, and that means dealing with your reality, and not feeding into the same system, changing your own anger, not being proud, not being arrogant, not being angry, not blaming, then you become a much more amazing human being, incidentally more happy, and therefore you can become more effective. And you can, and I can see it. I mean, starting with one person for us 7 years ago, we've now touched thousands of people's lives, and they in turn, each one of them, are touching many, many other people's lives, and so it spreads in a much more organic and deeply more meaningful way than just shouting and yelling, you know, which is only external. So I'm seeing in this way, you know, it's, for me it is extremely encouraging, having the courage to see the external violence and energy, but looking into ourselves and seeing that we're, you know, we've got that inside us too, and then changing that, and in that way trying to change the outside world. I think that's a very, for me, that's a really solid method. It's long term, as the Dalai Lama said, you've got to think in term, long term, not just give up, you know. Mm-hmm. And that for me is a much more effective way, and I find that very inspiring too.
Well, you said that so well. I've been thinking for many years I've been hearing this thing about, well, it doesn't make it, from some people, about stereotype of activists yelling and screaming like you just said. I know you know that's not always true.
Of course.
But
that
you know, you have to like get enlightened first, and I think, well, you know, that's like many lifetimes.
Sure. No, it's one step at a time, isn't it? If I do this amount of work on my own mind, I can do that amount. You know, I mean, that's why I like this nice analogy in Buddhism that a bird needs two wings. You've got the wisdom wing and the compassion wing. So, of course, the compassion wing is the activist wing, is the one you get out there and you do something to make the world a better place. But the Buddhist approach is, if you haven't got the wisdom to know what to do, when, how, which you can only get from working on yourself, having more wisdom and clarity and more space in yourself, then how can you be effective? And I can see this. The constant in my life, I can see it, whether I was a Catholic, a communist, a feminist or whatever, or now a Buddhist, the constant has always been, I don't want to be noble again, but I can remember it. As I said before, I've wanted to understand what makes things work, and I want to try and be effective. And so I'm seeing myself that the more I can put myself together, the more I can stop seeing myself as separate, this whole them and us mode that we all get into, and it's very easy to fall into that trap. I mean, I can see the world. I mean, I know what you mean by government and all the outside stuff, but if I can link myself to that and see, okay, I've got those problems in me, how about if I change mine, then I can have more understanding about why people are this way, and then when you have that wisdom, you can be more effective in trying to change it. Mm-hmm. So for me, it's a much more organic way to see the world and to feel part of it rather than this big kind of them and us world. It's very easy to fall into that trap. You understand what I mean?
I sure do. And it's really is both the inner and outer, for lack of a better way to put it.
That's exactly right. That's the one. I mean, we can't do just one job. I mean, this is what you can see too, whether it's people who work in social work or people who go work in, you know, in poor countries or starving countries, or people who work politically, which is the compassion wing doing. If you know, why people get burned out, why people get exhausted, why people go crazy, why people don't feel effective, is because we haven't done the wisdom wing properly, I think. Mm-hmm. But if you do the wisdom wing, which is meaning work on your own mind, feel yourself connected to everything else. See your own delusions, own those, and let go of those and become wiser and stronger. Then that whole wisdom wing gives your compassion great strength, and also you don't give up so easily because you're more skillful in your ability to see what's going on. And you don't, I mean, I'm seeing this, you don't give up, you know, you just don't give up. And that's what we really need to have, you know.
Well, I'm certainly feeling very inspired by hearing you talk because I'm dealing with this stuff all the time, that's for sure. And I'm starting to understand it more, there is no contradiction, that's for sure. And Venerable Robina Curtin, hearing you speak about these things is really meaningful to me because I know that you are involved in the world. I also want to ask you, and you just said about suffering has to do with denying reality. I've just made me think about people that I talk to who talk about me. Oh, you can stand all that suffering, and we don't want to hear about it because it's too upsetting, and we can't deal with it, and it's going to upset our nice day, and then we won't be so nice. You know, I wonder if you have any comments about that, or if you'd explain more what you mean about suffering being related to denying reality.
Well, I think the way Buddha's saying is, I mean, in a much more broad, deep way, his whole view of reality, which we know is karma. We know that Buddha doesn't talk about creators and things like this. Buddha says that whatever any being is experiencing, in the big way of talking, is due to our not being in touch with reality. And what we mean by reality, there's a million levels of reality, aren't there? But he means it at quite a deep level, that he's actually saying that we've got all these misconceptions deeply ingrained in our mind that we don't even notice, that cause us to not be in touch with reality at a very deep way, and that which impacts on the ordinary way. So I'm talking at quite a deeper level, but not meant to be esoteric about it. And so what he really means by that is the more we can clear out attachment and anger and fear and confusion and pride, which are like the filters through which we see things, which distort our world, it's in this way we're not in touch with reality. But I think the point you made is a very good one. It's very common when you get into a spiritual path, you know, it's dealing with being kind and loving and compassionate, and we have all these very mystical misconceptions, I think, about what a spiritual path is, and especially I think Buddhism, which I think is just such a disservice, because the reality is, you know, the world is full of intense suffering, and we have to understand why it's there, but we have to have a very positive, yes, constructive, and if you like, happy attitude towards it. I mean, if you look at the Dalai Lama, he has every reason in this world to be out of his brain with misery. I mean, look at his, 1.2 million or more Tibetans over the last 40 years, the country destroyed, every bit of all the natural resources destroyed. I even heard 10 years ago that they're trucking trees out 24 hours a day, you know, for 40 years. I mean, it's just overwhelming, but everyone can see if they look at him, he's this, you know, this really healthy, happy, smiling, practical, down-to-earth human being. But we get all kind of, oh, wow, he's a Buddhist, he loves his enemies, it all sounds so airy-fairy. But the thing about not able to deal with reality is because we've not dealt with ourself. That's the point, I think. This is why the wisdom wing is so important. Yes, the point is to be good, quiet, kind, clear, happy, blah, blah, blah. Well, as a dear friend of mine, you know, who's a therapist but a Buddhist, she said, it's like being a practitioner means really looking at yourself honestly, dealing with who you are. Because when you can deal with this, then the suffering on the outside does not deter you. It does not make you miserable because you're linking yourself with it. You're connecting yourself. It's not just this airy-fairy, oh, wonderful, lovely, spiritual California huggy-feely, you know. It's such a misconception.
What about this whole bringing in the light, holding the light? How do you like that?
I don't even know what that means. I don't use words like that. I just think being a spiritual practitioner for me is a person who's dealing with their own mind. As one Lama puts it, Lama Yeshe, it's being your own therapist. It's really, that's the wisdom wing, really dealing with who you are, owning responsibility for your own pain, your own anger, your own jealousy, learning to have the confidence, which Buddha says we all have, to change. I'm not stuck with that. That's not at the core of my being. And identifying with my positive qualities. Then when I get out to make the world a better place, I don't get deterred. I go to the prisons and I can get more inspired because I see people's human hearts and people's human potential and people's effort to deal with their suffering. So to me, I find it humbling and inspiring, not exhausting at all. People ask me very often, isn't it exhausting for you? No way, you know. But if you're working on your own mind, that's I think, I'm not saying I'm doing such a good job, but for me it really makes sense. And therefore, there's no fear of anything then, you know.
And it's a lot of hard work. The Dalai Lama himself says he practices, which means looking into his own mind and praying, I guess.
Well, I mean, just practicing means dealing with who you are and then getting out there and putting it into action and doing both these wings. We've got to do both. Then there's some sanity in yourself, and then you can bring sanity and confidence to others, you know.
So you have this magazine called Liberation Magazine of FPMT's Liberation Prison Project. Mm-hmm. And now we're getting down to the end of the show here, so if people want to get their pencils and paper, we're going to give contacts. And also, you are the subject of an award-winning documentary called Chasing Buddha, Pilgrimage to India and Nepal, you being the Venerable Robina Corton.
Uh-huh. Well, no, Chasing Buddha is a film that my nephew, who's a filmmaker in Australia, made. And it was, I think, a couple of years ago. And that was, that's, I think, showing around on some of the channels from time to time. But this is, you know, the other thing is a pilgrimage we do every year to India and Nepal, to the holy places. But the magazine Liberation, people are very welcome to get a copy. So if they can write to Liberation Prison Project, P.O. Box 31527, San Francisco, California 94131. So, yeah, people are very welcome to get a copy of our magazine, which tells about the work we're doing around the world in Australia, but also we're dealing with people in Thailand now. We're supporting people in Russia in prison, in Morocco. And then again, that's another whole story of intense suffering. I mean, if you compare the prisons there, the prisons in this country are like paradise. So it shows it's all relative, you know. Yeah. So, yeah, so people are very welcome to get a copy of our magazine or to just look on our webpage, www.liberationprisonproject.com, or give us a call. We're here. We're working full-time. We have an office in San Francisco.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. Where are you off to next?
Actually, to New York, where His Holiness the Dalai Lama will be in very soon. And they've organized a meeting with about 20 ex-prisoners, Buddhist prisoners, and a few of us will be there meeting with His Holiness and the prisoners, which will be very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Really? Okay, well, thank you so very much for your time for this interview, Venerable Robina Corton. And my name's Sue Supriano. Thanks for listening.
May I just finish with a little prayer? We call it a dedication prayer. And it's just saying, it's a little wish that all the compassion grow and the grow in the hearts of all beings. Lama Sangye Drugyune Drowa Chikyang Malupa Deyi Sala Gepasho Chang chub sem chog rin po che ma kye pa nam kye gyu chig kye pa nyam pa me pa yang gong ne gong du pel ba sho.
That was the Venerable Robina Corton with a dedication prayer in Tibetan.
Yes.
To order a copy of the program you just heard, write down the following information. The email is sue@suesupriano.com. That's Sue, S-U-E, at Sue Supriano, SUESUPRIANO.com. Or the telephone is 510-883-1979. That's 510-883-1979.